Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, how stress from climate change leads to increasing violence against women. And the chance discovery of old photographs in Uganda has been turned into a film. Nakabia Winnie is the daughter of Kibate Aloysius Salongo, the man who captured the lives of people in the village of Mbirizi.
Seeing my father's photographic work celebrated and shared with the world is not something I can just take for granted. It's beyond what I expected in my entire life.
We'll also be hearing from the actor and filmmaker Ndare Mbaho Mwine, who found those photographs and made a film about them. It's Friday, the 29th of November. First, we go to South Korea. There's a big United Nations conference underway in Busan, a city in South Korea. And if agreement is reached, it would mark a major step in the fight to protect the environment. Delegates from 175 countries are meeting to try to agree on a global treaty to put an end to plastic pollution. This would be the first time all the countries of the world have made a legally binding agreement to deal with plastic waste. And not a moment too soon. Plastic pollution is a big problem with serious environmental, social, economic, and health consequences. The United Nations estimates that about 20 million tons of plastic waste ends up in our seas and oceans annually. But there is resistance to targets, not least from big business and industry, because plastic starts its life as oil. Oil is then made into polymers, which are used to mold plastic. Then chemicals are added. So there are a lot of powerful private and national interests at play. Now, I've been speaking to someone who's been in the room at these negotiations and seen these difficulties play out firsthand. Njai Sheikh Silla is Senegal's chief negotiator and expert advisor to the Chemicals Management Committee of Senegal. He spoke to me well past 11 p.m. last night after a long day of negotiations in Busan.
We finished all contact groups. From any contact group, we didn't have any clean text that we can send to the legal drafting group by now. Now we are proposing with the chair to hold tomorrow informal consultation on sending issues, coming up with a report. We can have some texts that the chair can propose to the head of delegation meeting around 4 p.m.
So tell us this. What is being negotiated? What are you trying to achieve?
We try to achieve this instrument, the legal binding instrument on plastic pollution and litter marine, to be a legal binding one applicable to all countries, to ask for African group supported by many other developing countries. The financial mechanism is key to us in our compliance system that can assist for the compliance of the parties.
So what are the difficulties in reaching an agreement?
The difficulties first is if you go to the upstreams on the definition, we have some difficulties. When you go to the supply, the production, product design, the chemical of concern, those chemicals being in the plastic, there is difficulty. When you go to the finance part, there is a difficulty because developed country are proposing the global facilities, and while the developing country are proposing an independent standalone fund to fulfill their commitment under this treaty. For the final provision, there are less difficulties there. We have two parts of difficulty mainly, the financial part and the production, because we are tackling the full life cycle of plastic. And this full life cycle of plastic, some are starting from the polymers to the waste, and others want to start from the product design to the waste.
Okay, and, let me see if I understand what's going on. So firstly, there are difficulties about money in order to tackle the problem. And then there are also difficulties in what exactly the problem is. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is the case on the money. And the other difficulty is to protect the industry, the production from the oil. We produce the polymers and we want to have a target, a production target on these polymers to reduce them. Because as far as the polymers continue to be producing in big quantity, we cannot achieve the global target of reduction of the plastic in the world.
So what's the target? No plastic or certain amounts of plastic only or plastic made by certain products only? What is the ultimate objective?
No, there are some plastics that we cannot tackle. Those are very useful and not present in the environment. But the single-use plastic, the bottle, the bag, all this kind of plastic have to be eliminated, reduced and eliminated. For all plastic also, to consider the circular economy of the treatment of this plastic at the end of life, we need to not have a harmful chemical on this plastic so that the environment will not affect it.
Tell us why plastic is so dangerous and why we need to eliminate it.
Plastic is so dangerous because they contain some chemicals that, depending on the way you eliminate it, if it is open burning, people don't know and they breathe this chemical component and it's very dangerous. For microplastic are present in our body, there is some scientific evidence on that. And also for animals, if you go to all African country, you will see some animals dying because of plastic in their body, in their stomach. And also for the visual environment in many areas also, you have the single-use plastic on the trees, on the land. And this one also is not a nice picture for the environment. Because normally in the environment, you want to see the water, you want to see the bird, you want to see some nice picture, but not plastic in all trees. And mainly is the chemical aspect of the plastic that is dangerous, because sometimes you don't know and you are using something dangerous for human life.
Why is it important for Senegal that you achieve the objectives of moving towards banning plastic and getting money to ban plastic?
Senegal first start, like many developing countries, to have one law and second law. One law in 2016, a second law in 2020. And we face the difficulty to apply this law because whatever you do, the plastic is present everywhere in the shop and used. But now, to have a global instrument applicable to all countries will regulate the trade, the production of plastic, and globally be reduced in the world. And this treaty also will help for the implementation because we have plastic in our seas, lakes, and rivers. We have plastic in the environment, and we need also to split to other technologies and to use other substitutes than the plastic, like paper or any other material to replace some bottle, single-use plastic. And for the capacity building and the regulations that you put in place, you need some incentive, you need some money to do that, especially for the industry if you want to make some investment to change the technology and to produce environmentally sound plastic with less harmful chemicals inside. All these, you need to have some investment to help your industry. Otherwise, your economy will be affected.
Now, lots of African countries have actually banned single-use plastic. I know South Africa has, Kenya has, Rwanda has, among others. So there is a lot of initiatives going on around this. I'm just wondering, how close do you think you are to agreement?
We will be close to the agreement. We hope that by Sunday, we will have a clear view on this. If not, maybe we will need additional work just before the diplomatic conference, somehow in May, June 2025, to finalize this instrument. But the best thing we want is a legally binding instrument that ban plastic, but not any treaty, very weak treaty. Better not have treaty than have a very weak treaty because you cannot apply it. And from COP to COP, conference of parties to conference of parties, you spend money, you spend time, and you will not achieve anything because everybody is protecting his industry, oil production, polymers production, chemical production, and want to make money. We have to think about environment sometime and be together to protect the earth.
Thank you so much. That's been really interesting.
I thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Njai Sheikh Sylla, Senegal's chief negotiator at the United Nations Plastics Conference in Busan. If you want to know more about the issue and what happens as negotiations reach a finale this weekend, head online to bbc.com/news or tune into the BBC World Service. We know that climate change damages the environment. What we are only now beginning to understand is that it damages relations between people as well. The connection wasn't made before, but a new report by the United Nations Population Fund shows that rising global temperatures is making intimate partner violence worse. But with figures that show that a woman is killed every 10 minutes and the fact that she's killed by a partner or family member, how much worse can it get? Much, much worse, I'm sorry to tell you. This year, we covered stories about femicide from Kenya and Nigeria on the podcast. November the 25th was the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. The campaign to end it runs until September the 10th. The UN research shows that in sub-Saharan Africa, the number of women experiencing this violence could nearly triple, going from 48 million in 2015 to 140 million women by 2060, if temperatures rise by more than 4% by the end of this century. So, how is climate change linked to the increase in violence against women? I leave it to Lydia Zigomo, the regional director of the United Nations Population Fund for East and Southern Africa, to explain. Can you explain to us the connection between the climate crisis and the increased rates of intimate partner violence in sub-Saharan Africa?
Essentially, what we're talking about is the fact that already in sub-Saharan Africa, we have high rates of intimate partner violence. The impact of climate change is twofold. One is the rising temperatures, and those temperatures have an impact in terms of just how people are responding to them within the communities where they live. So if you think about the fact that the most likely place where women and girls face violence is in the home or extended family. This is where the issues of intimate partner violence begin to play a role. With respect to these events when they happen, and we saw that during COVID, if you think about it. And remember that the other aspect of climate change is that not only does it increase the temperatures, the temperatures are rising, but we also see more frequent severe weather events. And when those happen, there can also be aspects around issues of disease outbreak. And we've been seeing that in the region, Eastern Southern Africa, with cholera outbreaks, Marburg, and so many other issues that are happening. So all these exacerbate already difficult situations under which people live. And often the ones most impacted are and most vulnerable to climate change are those living on sort of the margins, the poor, those in rural areas where, of course, you see the impact also on agriculture and food security of these extreme weather events and also rising temperatures with increased droughts, increased flooding. So all of that increases the tension, if we can call it that, within homes to levels where perhaps aggression becomes the typical response of partners when any sort of issue arises within the home. So this is the way in which it actually works. It reinforces and increases the episodes of violence within the home.
Could you share examples where we have seen a direct correlation between the climate crisis and violence against women?
So in terms of what we see on the ground at the moment, and people may not necessarily in their heads link this directly in their day-to-day lived realities to climate change. But these are some of the ways in which we are seeing the evidence of this. So for instance, you go to an internally displaced camp in, for instance, Burundi, where because of the rising temperatures, flooding has been a big issue. So the flooding is not just coastal areas, but even where there are lakes and rivers. These were originally fishing communities who lived along the side of the rivers and lakes. They are flooded out. They've been flooded out, for instance, since April of this year, and they're still living outside of their community in IDP camps now. You talk to the women and girls in those camps, and you can then see the evidence of how many of them have been violated within those settings and what has happened to them, and usually by who. So you won't get evidence of every single community, but it's modeling based on what we've been able to gather and the trends that are there at the moment of talking, for instance, to survivors in IDP camps or refugee camps, but also those presenting in hospitals or at one what we call one-stop centers, which are your shelters and your places where integrated gender-based violence services are offered under a holistic sort of provision of medical, psychosocial, legal, all provided under one roof, and talking to those women and looking at the evidence of what has been happening in their homes that has led them to seek those services.
So increased levels of intimate partner violence and violence against women is another symptom of the havoc that climate change is wreaking on society. Is that what you're saying, essentially?
It is. But there's more than just the intimate partner violence. And in some cases, actually, there's a connectedness between the intimate partner violence and other areas in which women and girls, particularly vulnerable and poor women and girls, are put at risk. So what the study also shows is that if you think about this fact that climate change is affecting most those who have contributed least to the greenhouse emissions, and most of these will be particularly women and girls in very vulnerable situations. In these situations, what we're also seeing with the rising temperatures is that it increases the incidence of stillbirths and miscarriages. So it's particularly challenging for women of a reproductive age, and they are even more at risk. So they're already at risk generally from intimate partner violence, increased by the stress of the difficulties of climate change and what it brings. And we also know that oftentimes when these type of events happen, who is blamed in our communities for that? And that can also be a stressor within already stressful relationships.
What do you mean? But also, when you ask who's blamed for the bad weather?
No, for that stillbirth or miscarriage.
Right.
And that can increase and be another stressor even within the existing relationship between that man and that woman and the extended family within that family.
So yet another burden befalling women and girls, and especially poor women and girls. They have no control over what people do about the climate. So what can be done?
So this is where we are saying that governments need to look at a number of issues. One, under COP29, what we tried to push for was part of the study that was done. This study that you're referring to also looked at, reviewed how many of the national plans that countries have put in place. And that was a way to try to influence more governments to actually put into their next set of national action plans and pay more attention to sexual reproductive rights and gender-based violence. So in Eastern Southern Africa, for instance, the report revealed that only 8 out of 19 national climate action plans referenced at all sexual reproductive health and gender-based violence, while most countries reference the impacts of climate change on sexual reproductive health and rights and GBV. Only a few actually outlined specific interventions and or initiatives to strengthen resilience to climate change through looking at the services that are provided in those countries for sexual reproductive health and rights and gender-based violence.
What are the chances of that happening, given that countries are barely managing to fulfill other obligations?
Well, at least at the end of COP29, as we know, $300 billion annually has been mobilized, or at least agreed to by 2035. But the target that developing countries wanted was $1.3 trillion.
Right.
So it's far short of what they were saying was needed to holistically address climate change. But it is at least something on the table. If developing nations, who, yes, we agree, are not responsible in the greenhouse emissions, but since their citizens, and particularly these poorer women and girls, are so at high risk, we're saying that those action plans that are going to be developed and that they are developing and which will respond and be hopefully be invested in by this money that's going to be coming must A, put women and girls at the center, B, ensure that some of that money does go to women-led organizations who are working on issues of climate change and looking at issues of gender-based violence and other sexual reproductive health issues, and C, it goes also to strengthening the health system and also the ability to invest in things like, for instance, mobile services, etc., adapting to the fact that climate change is real. It is with us. We may not be able to prevent it totally, but services should still be able to operate and to be at the service of these vulnerable women and girls in these communities.
Well, we are talking about money that we have yet to see. We were yet to see the money that was pledged last year and, you know, and 2 years before. So aren't we building pie in the sky here?
Well, if you don't have the plan, if and when the money comes, then you don't know what to do with it and you use it wrongly. So we are believing that it's important to already work with governments on the action plans. So that's what we've been doing and are continuing to do. Because when the money comes, it will be too late already to start talking about where it should go if the plans are not already there, they're understood and they're costed. And then the second thing is, of course, we need all of us to monitor and hold to account those who are pledging and committing, to ensure that that money actually does flow and that it is used for the right purposes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Lydia Zigomo, the Regional Director of the United Nations Population Fund in East and Southern Africa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Picture this. The sun is shining and a group of friends are on their way to a photography studio to capture a precious moment. Could be a wedding. Could be that you're wearing new clothes or a new car. That's what it was like in the olden days, before photographs could be taken on a phone and barely looked at afterwards. In those days, the memories that were captured on film were precious because they were physical and could get lost or destroyed. No storing in the cloud, no copies shared. It was that memory that motivated Ntare Guma Mbao Mwine to tell the story of a cache of photographs he chanced upon in a village in Uganda. Ntare is an actor and filmmaker who works in Los Angeles, and he was visiting home when he came upon photographs taken by Chibate Aloysius Saalongo, who recorded the lives of people from the rural town of Umbirizi back in the day and over many years. We'll hear the full story in just a moment, but Mr. Saalongo's daughter Nakaiba Winnie has been telling us about the impact her late father's photographs have had on her and the people captured in them.
Seeing my father's photographic work celebrated and shared with the world is not something I can just take for granted. It's beyond what I expected in my entire life. When I was still a little one, I had no idea that my father's photography had a long impact to the community. Not until in 2021, when Mr. Ntare brought an exhibition of his photographic work, something which brought us together as the family and the community people as well. It's one of the beautiful memories to me and my family at large. People did not only identify themselves on the exhibition, they also shared beautiful stories about my father. Some even stated that he must be the happiest soul in heaven to see different people gathering because of him. This exhibition did not only stop there. Mr. Ntare put in all his efforts and took it to the Ugandan Museum when Uganda was celebrating her 60 years of independence. Here, some of the family members attended, and I was among. The memories became afresh. It was our first time to sit in the same place with the president of the country because he was the one to open this exhibition. Anyone who came across my father's photographs got inspired because it's now a rare case to find such photos only captured in black and white. And I'm so humbled. I can't thank Mr. Ntare enough for being a very unique soul, a true friend to my father, to the family. Up to now, my dad is no longer alive. He has not given up on the documentary film of my father. He's still pushing nation to nation to see that my father's photographic work is seen by the world. We are so humbled as the family. We are really happy. It is not something small. We cannot just take it for granted. We can't thank him enough for real.
Nakaiba Winnie, remembering her father and how Ntare Guma's preservation of his work affected her and the people captured in those pictures. Ntare turned this body of work into an award-winning documentary called Memories of Love Returned. Here's the rest of this poignant story.
Take us back to the moment when you first saw those photographs.
It was a happy accident when I first met Chibate Aloisi Salungo. My car broke down in the small rural town of Imbirizi. And to pass the time waiting for the car to get repaired, I stumbled upon his studio. And he happened to be there, and I discovered this wealth of photographs he had taken over decades. And that set this journey in motion.
What was it about the photographs that grabbed you?
Chibate has this incredible skill of capturing moments of intimacy. He is a studio photographer, but you often feel like he wasn't shooting in a studio. He was capturing people in real moments, in their own environments, unaware of the camera, even though they're looking indirectly at the camera at times. It was really like a window into people's souls, which is so rare because often photos, studio photos, are staged and carefully directed and people are trying to show off but their wealth. But what he captured were windows into rural life.
And photographs for you have a very particular resonance because you spoke about losing many of your childhood photographs. So was that part of why you found this so enchanting and enthralling?
Yeah, my parents split when I was about 7 years old. They divorced and my mom moved back to Uganda. And in that process of moving back, most of my childhood photos were lost. And when I discovered this trove of photographs that Chibate had taken, I thought about the families in those photos and if they had their photos still or if the children of those people in those photos had seen these photos. And so it became a mission to try to find the people in the photographs, re-photograph them in some cases, and try to return these photographs. And so I staged this large outdoor exhibit, over 5,000 images, and it became this incredible meeting place for long-lost relatives to discover photographs of family members they had never seen.
Yeah. In fact, when you staged that outdoor exhibition at the petrol station where your car was being fixed, we spoke to you a couple of years ago on Focus on Africa, as was then the live program. This is now the podcast, slightly different version of that Focus on Africa. But you told a story then that absolutely gripped and enthralled me. Tell us about the reaction of people when they did see photographs. There's one specific story that I'm after.
There's so many stories. We wish we could have captured everything. We only had a two-camera crew. But there are hundreds, thousands of photographs, people making connections throughout. But there's a handful of them I think you might be remembering. One of these is Johnson Makanga, whose parents had died when he was a toddler and had never seen photos of his parents. And Johnson's uncle, his father's brother, saw this photograph of his dad and called Johnson over and said, look, this is your father and your mother. And he saw his parents for the first time, a photo of them for the first time. And he was in his, you know, in his late 20s or 30s. So it took his breath away. It took our crew's breath away to see that.
So you spoke about how societal attitudes like those influenced by Uganda's anti-gay laws have shifted the way people perceive intimacy and affection in photographs. For instance, men holding hands, which for so many people who travel across the African continent, wasn't something unusual until very, very recently. How did that affect the stories that you were able to tell in the documentary?
Well, there was the passing of this anti-gay bill in Uganda. Around the same time I was finishing up the documentary, and in Chibate's archive are series of images of same-sex friendships, or, you know, I'm not sure what their relationships were, but of people holding hands of same-sex. And that was very common back in the day, where you'd hold hands with your friend, your male friend and your female friend, and walk openly. That doesn't happen as frequently now, because of this bill. So that wasn't like a sort of political agenda. This was just of mine when I started unpacking this, but I didn't want to disclude these photos from the exhibit or from the documentary. And I had to figure out a way to discuss these photos. And this bill became a window into doing that because you don't see that anymore as much.
Your documentary is called Memories of Love Returned, and it's won many awards and it's premiered across continents. What do you think audiences respond to most about this when they see your documentary?
I think what has hit a a nerve with folks is how photographs are a window into our souls, into our lives, into our intimate moments, into celebrating some of the highlights of our life. And when those are all lost, a big part of ourselves are lost. Anyone who's lost a phone and all the photos on their phone feels that loss. And so you can imagine, like, all the people whose phones have been lost over 5 decades. Imagine if all those photos were found and publicly exhibited. The excitement and the joy of reconnecting with that work was kind of what has happened with this film. People are understanding the power of photography and valuing those images and the connections and the stories that they tell.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And I'm going to look at the photographs again and again, because you always see something new and interesting and different in a photograph, don't you?
Yes, exactly. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ntare Kuma Mbau Mwini, filmmaker and photographer. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson, Noor Abida, and Yasha Michelle in London. Blessing Aderogba was in Lagos. Paul Bajibinga was the senior producer in charge of the program, and Francesca Dunn was the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. A reminder that you can also now find us on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.